Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Hello and welcome to the China Geopolitics Podcast. My name is Jared Watt. I'm the specialist digital editor for the South China Morning Post. This Sunday will mark 3 months since Russia launched its war upon the people of Ukraine, in a week where the US Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman travelled to Brussels and made a fiery speech pointedly accusing Beijing of failing to condemn Russian war crimes, and declaring she hoped the PRC would learn the right lessons from the Ukraine war about not being able to separate the US from its allies. You're going to hear from my colleague Mark Magnier from our New York bureau about how lessons are being learned, all right, but it's more about China's military studying the tactics and weaponry being deployed in Ukraine, while Ambassador Qin Gang walks a careful line of diplomacy to put forward Beijing's position to conservative media outlets and Republicans. You're also going to hear what happened with the surprise visit of the person third in line to the US presidency, better known as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, to Taiwan. It's a fascinating tale. Meanwhile, on this side of the world, Xi Jinping has us all wondering what exactly he proposed in yesterday's speech at the annual Boao conference in Beijing. He announced something called the Global Security Initiative. And looking at the speech, it sounds like he's proposing something a lot like what the United Nations was set up to do, except China's going to be in the driver's seat. We're still digesting this, and no doubt you'll be reading more about it over the weekend on scmp.com. But we're going to start this week with the news of how a small island of some 700,000 people, just 1,800 kilometres from the northeast coast of Australia, has just landed a geopolitical bombshell into the Australian national election and US plans for its diplomatic and military pivot to the Asia-Pacific. Last December, you heard from senior Asia correspondent Maria Siao of the ongoing violence and unrest in Honiara, the capital city of the Solomon Islands, sparked by the government's decision to switch its allegiance from Taipei to Beijing. Maria is back this week after the announcement that the Solomon Islands have signed a secret deal with Beijing over security and possibly a military base. Now, right now, China has just one overseas military base in the Republic of Djibouti on the East African coast. Begging the question, has China just achieved a crucial strategic victory in the Southern Pacific, or indeed is this one of the greatest foreign policy failures in Australian history? Here's what the former chief of the Australian military, Admiral Chris Barry, had to say about it.
Australia was always a reliable friend of countries in the Pacific. And here we've got a secret treaty or a secret security pact that's been negotiated. We've not been involved. I mean, even when we put the lease down on the Port of Darwin, that was a public event. This is not. Now, what does it tell us about the last 15 years of assisting the Solomon Islands and the fact that they now feel that China is a better place to go to? I think, frankly, it's a failure of Australian government policy.
It's uncharted waters we're sailing into this week. On with the show. Maria Siao, great to talk to you again. Welcome back to the podcast. It's been rumoured for a while now, but on Wednesday this week, Solomon Islands Prime Minister Manasa Sogavare has announced his government had signed a security pact with China, quote, with our eyes open, but has refused to divulge the details of what's involved or when it might actually be published. What do we know about this deal?
Oh, well, Jared, first of all, thanks for having me on the podcast once again. I think, first of all, it is useful to understand the backdrop to the latest developments and, you know, about this draft agreement that we've seen, which was largely triggered in large part by this draft agreement in late March last month between China and the Solomon Islands, because in this controversial draft document, which was leaked on social media, China will be allowed to send police as well as armed forces to the Solomon Islands in order to maintain social order. It will also allow Beijing to deploy forces to protect the safety of Chinese personnel and major projects in the country. And this, as we know, is due to the anxieties and concerns following the riots last year in the Solomons, and which also led to the attacks, arson, looting, and so on, of Chinese businesses, shops, and interests in the country. What is more alarming to other powers in the region about the security deal is the concern that Solomon Islands will allow China to build a military base in the country, as well as allowing Chinese warships to be sent to the country, which means that these warships will essentially be located just 2,000 kilometers from the coastline of Australia. Even though the Solomon's prime minister has said that his country will not allow China to build a military base, this hasn't stopped both Australia and the United States from stepping up diplomatic pressure and calling on the Solomons not to sign this pact with Beijing. So in fact, Australia was so concerned with this agreement that it dispatched its minister for international development and the Pacific to the Solomons during mid-election, where he publicly called on the country's leadership to consider not signing this pact. He cited the spirit of regional openness and transparency. And of course, you know, we know that the United States has also sent its National Security Council Indo-Pacific coordinator, Kurt Campbell, who has reportedly arrived in Solomons on Thursday with a delegation of U.S. government officials. But with the deal already confirmed by the Solomon's prime minister on Wednesday, I think perhaps what remains to be done by Campbell is damage control, because the U.S. has essentially said that the agreement will destabilize the Solomons and will set a concerning precedent for the wider Pacific region. And of course, Washington has also said that it would reopen its embassy in the Solomons. So this will perhaps be one of the issues that Campbell will talk about when he is in the country. And of course, he's also expected to address the larger concerns about Chinese influence in the region, which of course will be uppermost on the minds of him and his delegation.
Maria, depending on what side of the geopolitical divide one takes, this is either the greatest failure of Australian foreign policy in decades or a masterstroke of Chinese diplomacy to gain a strategic foothold in the Pacific. What are your sources telling you?
I think, you know, it would be too far of a stretch to say that this is a masterstroke on the part of Chinese diplomacy. I think it is probably a failure of Australian foreign diplomacy, as many of my analysts have been telling me, because they've been saying that, you know, efforts by Solomons to become closer with China is to be expected, because China is a power to be reckoned with. It is a power that is keen to protect and expand its interests in the region. It is a power with development funds, with economic goodies to share. And best of all, it's a power that comes with no strings attached. And all of these are in total opposite to what the Australians are offering. And we have seen that countries, especially Australia, which has been long one of the biggest donors in the Solomons, over the years, they have appeared as high-handed, they've appeared as overbearing in their dealings with Pacific countries. Australia, for example, it exerts a strong influence on Solomon's development, finance, economy, and so on. But over time, it has imposed sanctions, it has threatened to terminate aid. But with China, these, again, are no strings attached. These are not possibilities that the Solomons has to contend with. So in that sense, you can say that in recent years, the ball game has been turned around and almost in Solomon's favour.
And it's interesting you say that Australia's been criticised of being high-handed. One of the defining issues of the century for the world, but particularly in the Pacific, is the one of climate change. The Solomon Islands and many nations in that region have all directly appealed to Australia to do something about climate change. Scott Morrison's government's response is to dig more coal mines, go fracking, and really pour money into fossil fuel development.
Overall, there is this sense among certain quarters in the Solomons and also in the region that despite Australia being there in the first place, you know, Canberra has not done enough to address the region's, including Solomon's, concerns about underdevelopment, about climate change issues, which, of course, you know, is one of the biggest issues affecting countries in the Pacific region. As one of the advisors to Solomon Islands wrote in an article recently, Australia has basically squandered its influence in the Solomons for more than a decade, because you know that the Australians, they undertook the Ramsey operation for 15 years, which ended in 2017. And that, of course, refers to the regional assistance mission to the Solomon Islands, which is also known as Operation Help Me Friend. This is basically a partnership between the people and the government of Solomon Islands and 15 contributing countries of the Pacific region, but it's mainly funded and led by Australia. But however, despite 15 years, this operation did not stabilize the country, which remained poor, remained filled with political divisions. And of course, we know we shouldn't let the US off the hook either. I mean, the US did not fare any better. It has often ignored the Pacific countries over the years. So it's probably not far wrong for the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin to say this week that the US embassy in Solomon Islands has been closed for 29 years and that the most recent visit to Fiji made by a US Secretary of State was 37 years ago. You know, Wang Wenbin basically said that several US officials now fancy a visit to some Pacific Island countries all of a sudden. After all these years, are they doing so out of care for these countries? Or do they have ulterior motives? Well, I guess that's really something to think about, right?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. Wang Wenbin's comments really hit home very sharply because, you know, for years, ever since the Barack Obama administration, there was this talk of the US pivot to the Asia Pacific, and we hear all of this stuff. But of course, mostly it's about either moving troops to the north of Australia or indeed multi-billion dollar weapons contracts being sold to the Australians. What kind of diplomatic rearguard action is going on here? You mentioned Kurt Campbell has landed in the Solomon Islands just yesterday. What's expected to happen?
Well, I think basically what he will do, because now that the damage has already been done, is basically to engage in damage control. I think he will try to find out the security concerns about the Solomon Islands, finding ways that the US can address. It might be a little bit too late because now that the deal has already been signed, I think what the US essentially can do is to just go ahead with its initial plan to set up the embassy in Solomon's and to find ways to further counter Chinese influence. And I think this might mean that the US might discuss more developmental issues and ways to assist on the Solomon, which basically is a country with 700,000 people. You know, I mean, if the US had been interested in following up and in helping the Solomon, it could have done that a long time ago. You don't need a lot of money to help the Solomon. I mean, you know, with 700,000 people, you know, a couple of million dollars of developmental assistance basically goes a long way, but it hasn't done that. So if it's planned to play catch up, then I say good luck, because I think if I were the Solomon leaders, you know, looking at this scenario playing in front of my eyes, I would probably go for China. I mean, China is giving me so much and asking for so little in return. Most importantly, I think this will also help the Solomon government remain in power, which is, of course, one of the biggest misgivings and concerns felt by people and politicians in the country, which is that the deal with China is largely an instrument to allow this current government and prime minister to remain in power.
It's interesting you mentioned about the no strings attached assistance from China to Solomon Islands. What of Taiwan in this? Because, you know, going back to December, we spoke about the roots of the conflict here. We had a separate province, a separate island wishing to align itself with Taiwan. Taiwan was offering aid as well, but only very specifically to those people who were supporting Taiwan. Have we heard anything from Taiwan in this?
Not explicitly, because right now, because both sides have no diplomatic relations. But now that you've brought up the issue, I think it is very likely that Taiwan will continue to want to maintain ties with people on the island who still support Taiwan. And there is still a large segment of people who do still support Taipei. And I think there is still the possibility. And we've also seen indications that Taipei has also pumped in developmental funds, even in the lack of bilateral ties. So I think that is going to continue. So this sense of geopolitical rivalry and power play is still expected to continue, but perhaps in a less open way, because it probably does not also want to invite criticism or anger from Beijing. At least it does not want to confront Beijing directly in a direct way of confrontation. So I think that is still likely to continue, and we'll see probably more of it in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, Maria, obviously there's a lot more to come on that, starting, of course, with Kurt Campbell, the Indo-Pacific coordinator for the US National Security Council. He's in Honiara right now trying to walk back or just talk to the government about the deal, of which we know no details, signed with China. Look forward to speaking to you again. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Roger, thanks for having me, and it's always a pleasure speaking to you.
Mark Magnier is with our New York Bureau. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Jared.
Mark, you've been watching China's ambassador to the US, Qin Gang, take to the talk shows and the op-ed pages this week. But I feel the need to read a quote of his from your article on SEMP.com. And this was from an op-ed he published last month. And it says, quote, "Many Americans are understandably trying to understand where China stands as the crisis in Ukraine unfolds." Mark, do you think Americans are any closer to understanding where China stands on the war on Ukraine?
I think the fact, as you mentioned, that they've sort of been on a public relations push, the article that you quoted, as well as I was at Harvard on Saturday when he and Huang Ping, the New York Consul General, both gave comments and speeches, and then another opinion piece in the National Interest magazine on Monday, which is a sort of a conservative foreign policy book, trying, I think, to clarify what many see as a rather confusing and somewhat contradictory stance on Ukraine.
And I'm curious, it seems to contrast markedly with the wolf warrior style, how do we say, throwing barbs and rocks via Twitter that we've seen other embassies and consulates around the world. Is that what you're seeing, that this is a quite measured approach?
It has been a very noticeable shift, not just for the foreign ministry overall group of cadres, but even for Qin Gang himself. You know, he has an interesting background. He was actually a news assistant at United Press International. That's how he started his career, with a Western news organization, before going into the foreign ministry and rising pretty quickly until he joined in 2005 the information department and made his name in the Wolf Warrior camp himself. At one point, he compared the China's absorption of Tibet to Abraham Lincoln's emancipation of enslaved African Americans, and similar sort of pushback statements. So a lot of people expected a very tough combative line. He has very quickly switched into a more, you know, traditional ambassador role here, trying to work out some arguments through these various efforts that will try to reach the American and, I guess, Western audiences with a bit more nuance, with something that attempts to sort of make a consistent set of reasons for things, rather than the often traditional kind of rather sharp pushback that we've often seen that can read as very defensive to Western ears.
And Mark, I can't help but notice there must be a very interesting dynamic that Qin Gang is looking at with the US politics and US media, where you have, you know, Fox News and the right wing of the Republican Party really not quite cheerleading Vladimir Putin, but really leaning towards him. But when it gets to China, you get a bipartisan kind of wall. How do you think he's playing that?
Well, I think in some way it's interesting because it's probably a bit of a compliment to some extent, in that I think deep down, probably Washington views the real adversary, the real threat to its top dog position over the long term to be China. Whereas Russia, they can probably parse in the overriding context of the partisan warfare going on domestically now. The sort of hawkish or Republican admiration for Putin is fascinating. It's probably no one opinion, or no one viewpoint, but more a combination of disparate, disgruntled camps. You know, part of it probably picking up on former President Donald Trump's strange obsession with Putin. Part of it just because in the polarity, the fact that Biden has moved to support Ukraine, therefore it must be bad and will go in the opposite direction. And part of it probably just, you know, he's a strong man with strength and we don't have one. So all of those, I think, combined. So in terms of Qingdao and the China strategy, on top of what you had mentioned, of course, is this complex sort of ledge that Qingdao and China more broadly are trying to walk, where they want to keep the relationship with Russia for various reasons of feeling embattled, perhaps by the alliances that Biden is building, but they don't want to jeopardize these massive markets, especially at a time when the Chinese economy is increasingly wobbly, and you've got the big show coming in the fall with Xi Jinping being named to his third and perhaps fourth and fifth stint as head of the party. And that, back to sort of this communication strategy, is just some of the contradictions and some of the fence walking that China is trying to do right now on its position.
A lot has been said, a lot has been written about China's relationship with Russia regarding the Ukraine invasion and war, its refusal to condemn the invasion and the various massacres and crimes against humanity. But you're working on something else. You're working on an upcoming feature that's all about understanding Russia's war in Ukraine, but from a Chinese military perspective. What have you found?
Yes, Jared, that's, I think, just coming out. So the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, is a very careful organization, befitting, I think, how China in general approaches change. You can kind of think of the reform and opening that China has had, where it will take a special economic zone and liberalize the economy in a small little way and look and watch and then do it on a slightly bigger framework and this sort of thing. And you see this very much with the PLA on how they learn lessons. So what we tried to do with this piece is look, it will take years before we truly know what lessons the PLA draws. And it will also really depend, which we don't know yet, whether Russia ultimately, through whatever tactics, comes out looking like a winner or not. This will also determine, to some extent, the PLA's thinking on this. But what we tried to do is get some of those who look very, very closely at China, its history, the PLA, its history, its tactics, and get some of the lessons that we would expect them to draw. And you have to remember that the current modernization program, which was sort of unrolled in 2015 with their white paper, really was inspired, if you will, by the shock that it saw in the 1990 invasion Gulf War on Iraq. And so that gives you some sense of the time that it takes it to absorb some lessons. that's a long time. Not that the Pentagon moves like Johnny Swifty either, or most militaries, but some of the lessons that, according to PLA watchers, that appear to stand out are, one of these is that no matter how much you think your playbook is ready for real time, that all plans, I'm sure there's a famous Clausewitz statement on that, but basically all plans fall apart as soon as the first shot is fired. And so this has been a real eye-opener, I think, for China, which has really, more lately than other areas like the economy, has taken a lot of its cues from the Russian military. It still gets a lot of its hardware from them. It has obviously has taken a Chinese aircraft carrier. It has participated as a kind of junior member in some of the massive exercises that Moscow has organized. And so that's a shock. I think probably another lesson that people were telling me is that they will redouble their very rapid nuclear weapon building program. They are estimated to have around 400 now by Pentagon figures, and that's expected to rise to 1,000 by 2030. And they are doing that because they, I think, watched Moscow be able to use that as a bit of a leverage against NATO and the West to push back. And I think they reiterated, Moscow reiterated that threat last week, was it, when it was named that Sweden and some others were thinking of joining NATO. And so then I think, too, a kind of a secondary lesson perhaps from them is that arguably Russia may never have invaded Ukraine if, you know, Ukraine was the depository for a lot of the nuclear arsenal that the Soviet Union had and was convinced to give it up by joint pressure tactics by both Moscow and, ironically, the U.S. So that's kind of another lesson on this that, I think North Korea also does that. They'd just be a poor developing country and no one would take them seriously if you didn't have nuclear weapons. So I think that's one of the lessons of many that the PLA may draw.
Mark, there's something else I need to raise with you before you go. And that was a fortnight ago, we saw the image of the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, walking the streets of Kiev with a Vladimir Zelensky. The UK won't send troops. The US won't send troops, but the UK would send their prime minister. We also had this surprise announcement that Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the US House of Representatives, was going to fly into Taiwan and have meetings. Now, that was called off because she tested positive for COVID. Now, I checked the history books. The last time a US speaker flew to Taiwan was 1997, and it was Newt Gingrich. Have you heard anything more about this? Is the trip being rescheduled? Is it just passed from memory?
This, from my understanding, Beijing really went pretty ballistic when word leaked out about this. There was someone I know had an opinion piece sent to them by a retired PLA general, suggesting that they were going to potentially intercept her aircraft as it came in. It became very clear that amidst all of the noise in the U.S.-China relationship and the dialed-up rhetoric out of the Wolf Warriors and others, that this was a really serious issue. And so there was some, I don't think it's true because you couldn't get away with it in leaky Washington, but there was some suggestion from people I heard that Nancy Pelosi quickly got COVID to avoid the trip. So at any rate, it has been called off. There has not been any rescheduling to date. We will see if it does. There was some questioning whether this was because of her often pro-Tibet, anti-China stance coming out of her constituency in ever-liberal San Francisco Bay Area. But as someone said to me, the Chinese know the U.S. Constitution better than most Americans. She's third in line to the president. This would be a really, really big bit of symbolism. And she's also incredibly effective, almost a magician at times in being able to hold the caucus together and get legislation passed. And so these were not lost on Beijing.
Mark Magnier in our New York Bureau, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jared.
That's all for this week's episode and a brief bit of news. While we're not listed as an official nominee you can vote for, a big thanks to the Webby Awards for making us the only non-American podcast listed in the Best News and Current Affairs category. Now, this show only happens each week because of the support of the journalists and editors in the various SEMP newsrooms here in Hong Kong, Beijing, US, and Brussels. and it only exists thanks to the late great editor from the SCMP Political Economy Desk, John Carter. But most of all, it's only here because you choose to listen to it each week wherever you are in the world, or indeed wherever you are here in Hong Kong. Thank you for your support. It is a great pleasure and privilege to make this podcast for you. Now, don't forget, you'll be reading the latest developments, analysis, and reactions to all we've talked about and everything else that happens tonight and through the weekend at scmp.com. Follow the SCMP team on Twitter at SCMP Economy. You can follow me at Jay Watt. Stay safe, stay well. See you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.